We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to have you both back. Mr.
Yes.
Parrish, from your long journeys.
I wasn't aware where Maria was gone.
No, I was here. Yeah, I'm not sure Mike was here.
Oh.
I'm never sure I'm here. All right. Plenty to cover, and starting with Signature Gathering.
Yes, we've got three initiatives out there. Now that the weather's turned nice, people will be out on the streets gathering signatures for these three different initiatives.
Actually, there's more than that, but
we want to talk about
Tim Eyman has an initiative. We could talk about that.
No, we have three that we want to talk about. One is a group called Action Seattle is going to be out on the streets collecting signatures for a proposal to elect some of the city council members by district. The proposal is to change the current election system, which has all of the city council members being elected at large, basically by a vote by the entire city's population, to five of the nine city council members being elected by district. So voters, and I should point out, too, that voters have seen an initiative like this before.
Twice
before, to elect all the city council members by district. In 1995 and 2003, voters voted them down. Supporters of the initiative say that if you elect by district, you're going to have more diversity on the council and that it will take less money for candidates to run because they're only having to cover a district instead of the entire city, and that it will people elected by district will be more responsive to the issues in their neighborhood. And as we all know, neighborhood issues have been widely neglected by the city in recent years in particular. And that once you have district representatives on the city council, then citizens with complaints will know who to go to. Right now, you don't always know who you should contact on the city council, or you get the runaround. You contact the wrong city council member, and then you're told to contact somebody else who tells you, no, I'm not the person responsible for that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So on the other hand, opponents, of course, have come up with their lead argument as, district city council members will be less responsive to citywide issues. And, of course, what they mean is citywide issues like the Mercer Beautification Project. District council members wouldn't necessarily support building a parking garage for Nordstrom's. They wouldn't necessarily want to see a downtown underground aquarium built for the city. They wouldn't support the Paul Allen Streetcar to Nowhere or money for low-income housing that's really for the middle class and upper middle class, et cetera. So I urge people to go out and sign that initiative.
Yeah, I actually don't find the argument that it will cost less money to run a campaign that compelling, although it makes it more possible to doorbell a district as opposed to the entire city. But, you know, it's just as easy for special interests to pour money into a neighborhood race, maybe even easier. But the other arguments are pretty compelling, particularly because the way that city council is structured right now, each of the nine members has his or her own little fiefdom depending on which committee they chair. So if you want, if you have a parking complaint, you go to one council person. If it's a zoning complaint, you have another. It's public safety and so forth. And what happens as a result is you get this very collegial atmosphere on the city council where nobody wants to go against anybody. Most of the negotiation is done behind closed doors, and you wind up getting a lot of 9-0 votes, usually in support of the mayor. And that really has, with a few rare exceptions over the last 20 years, been the norm on the Seattle City Council. And it's been a pretty toxic atmosphere for actually solving any of the problems that we have here. And there's the real problem of representation, particularly in the neighborhoods, because right now, downtown business interests and special interests pretty much dominate Seattle electoral politics. And this is one way of addressing that. This measure almost passed the two previous times that it's been. Last time it was well ahead in the polling when a fundraising scandal came out about one of the persons who was bankrolling the initiative then, and it narrowly lost. So people are pretty optimistic this time, and I would also urge people to go out and sign it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I might mention also that the entrenched downtown interests would probably be thrilled if it were four city council members at large, four district, and one permanent seat for Paul Allen or his representatives. But since that's not the proposal, they're pretty against it.
Yeah. Another initiative is out on the streets. Referendum 71. This is an initiative I urge people to avoid. Conservative groups in the state have gotten together, found out probably a lot of funding from outside the state, I'm guessing, and they're seeking to undo legislation that has been passed recently to extend the same benefits to same-sex couples that married couples have in this state, and those folks will be out gathering signatures as well. I urge you to avoid signing Referendum 71.
Yeah. Finally, Initiative 100 for the city. This is something that's being put together by poverty and homeless advocates to try and stop construction of a new jail in Seattle, pointing out very correctly, I think, that a lot of the money is going for nonviolent drug offenders. The money could be better spent on diversion programs, and certainly could be better spent on the social programs that are being gutted as the city faces a budget shortfall than building yet another shiny new jail. So, yes, on Initiative 100.
All right. Moving on, Sound Transit having a vote this week?
Yeah, this was reported in the Seattle Times. They said that Sound Transit passed a motion at their Thursday meeting that would set the preferred alignment for light rail through Bellevue as an at-grade alignment rather than as a tunnel alignment, but that it directed Sound Transit to study building a tunnel if the city comes up with the money. Well, that's a little bit of a mischaracterization of the actual motion. I read the motion, and it does say that the preferred route is at grade and not the tunnel. However, it directs Sound Transit and the city of Bellevue to look for funding sources for a tunnel and come up with options for funding the tunnel by September of this year. And then it goes on to say that if the city and the Sound Transit Board are successful in finding options for funding the tunnel, not in finding the money, but actually finding viable options for funding the tunnel, that the Sound Transit Board then will, quote, give future consideration to a tunnel as the preferred alternative, which is, I think, is a much stronger wording than the Seattle Times suggested in their report. Also, the motion directs Sound Transit to evaluate a tunnel design along with the current at-grade route. So currently taxpayer money that goes into Sound Transit is being used to study a tunnel alternative. Also, the motion specifies that the tunnel not be the cheaper cut-and-cover tunnel, but a bored tunnel, which was the preferred, the more expensive bored tunnel, which is the preferred route by the Bellevue Business Owners Association.
And in a remarkable coincidence, the Seattle Times, which has been overtly hostile to light rail in general, let alone expanding light rail to the east side, because it's a waste of money, now because the Bellevue Business Establishment is behind the bored tunnel, suddenly they're all in favor of the bored tunnel. So
explain that.
And well, I can't. We don't have time. But it does point up a trend which I noticed also coming back into town with the coverage of the teachers union flap, where Superintendent Maria Goodloe Johnson essentially fired the teachers, ripped up their labor contract, and then rehired them so they could be paid for one less day per year. Since the demise of the print version of the PI, the Seattle Times firewall between its editorial content and its news coverage seems to have crumbled. Its biases against labor in favor of downtown business establishments, wherever they may hide and so forth, seem to be much more blatantly expressed in their news reporting as well, and it's really a shame.
Yeah, and I've found many times in the last few weeks that I'll be reading an article out of the Seattle Times and thinking, Is this the opinion page? Did I just, not notice that I'm reading the opinion page? And no, it'll be an article that's meant to be reportage, but while you're reading it, you can't help but think this should be on the opinion page, just because of the slant of the article and the way, just the language. And
it's often not very subtle at all.
No, it is not subtle, not in the least. And I'm really, I can't say disappointed. I'd have to say I'm really alarmed by it.
Appalled, I think.
Appalled would be a good word, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, it looks like the state has a new attorney general.
Well, not the state, but Western Washington.
All right.
The permanent replacement for McKay, the gentleman who was booted out by Karl Rove a couple of years ago, will be Jenny Durkin, who is a name that's familiar to a lot of people here in the Seattle area. She's been on the right side, at least the progressive side of a lot of good causes over the years. Probably best known publicly as being the attorney who handed Dino Rossi and the Republicans their butts in court in 2005 in the disputed gubernatorial race. And this may well be a little bit of Democratic Party payback for her role in that. It's not as though the Attorney General's post hasn't been politicized before. And it's not as though the Obama administration is disavowing Bush policies. We'll get to that in a minute. But nonetheless, Durkin is one of the good guys or gals, and it's good to see her get that post. So congratulations.
All right. And Rob McKenna sending out a letter this last week.
On the other hand.
Yes, on the flip side, talking about naked political ambition. Rob McKenna, one of 10 state attorneys general who signed a letter to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton decrying the war crimes of Hamas and backing Israel's essentially attack on Gaza in the early part of this year. Now, why Hillary Clinton, let alone anybody in the Middle East, would give a fig what 10 state attorneys general think about something that happened 4 months ago would be one question. But of course, why Rob McKenna feels entitled to use state taxpayer money on this when it's so clearly outside the jurisdiction of his job would be another question. But to me, what this points up is that in the case of McKenna, and I would lay good money, many if not all of the other state attorneys generals who signed this letter, is they probably all have in common that they want to be governor someday or senator or some form of higher office where they can point to this and essentially appease the pro-Israeli lobby or the pro-Likud lobby. I should be more specific, because there's actually more of a range of opinion on Israeli policy within Israel than there is here in the United States.
Yeah. I think what alarmed me the most about this is that this letter was drafted and signed after these guys had made trips to Israel in order to study their justice
quote
system.
Unquote.
Yeah, and my question is...
And that those trips were paid for by?
By the Israeli government and Israeli lobbying organizations. And so, I look at that and I go, well, you know, this is clear tit for tat, you know. They took a trip on Israeli lobbyists' money, and now they're producing the goods for them. And it's really a sign of how a foreign government can influence foreign policy here within the U.S., but it's flown under the radar, and it's something that people should raise a stink about, because our foreign policy should not be based on influence that's bought by lobbyists from a foreign government.
Hey, you can break out that laugh track now, Mike.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me, too, that McKenna didn't see any kind of conflict of interest in that.
Yeah.
But all right, let's move on to national and this week's economic news.
Yeah, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the numbers, because, you know, this week we've been hearing more pundits saying again, over and over again, that we've turned a corner and the worst is behind us, and I think the wave has crested, and all those other bad metaphors that are supposed to give people confidence that they can go out and spend and, you know, invest again, et cetera, et cetera. Let's just talk a little bit about the real numbers. Median prices of homes fell 88% of cities surveyed by the National Association of Realtors last month. That's 134 cities out of 152. In the same report, cities where the sales volumes rose, that's often the number that's quoted by these pundits saying, oh, things are getting better because housing sales are picking up. Well, in cities where the sales volume rose, that's where you often had the steepest price declines. Places like Fort Myers, Florida, which saw a 50% increase in sales, has also seen a massive fall in prices. Other cities that saw a 40% plus increase in sales are places like Akron, Ohio, San Jose, California, Phoenix, Arizona, Sarasota, Florida, Riverside, California. You'll notice California, Florida, Nevada, et cetera. Those are all places where there have been massive foreclosures and sales prices have been falling very quickly. And of course, the reason that's true is that foreclosures now make up half of all home sales in the nation right now. And of course, if you look at the U.S. government's tax credit, it's for first-time home buyers. First-time home buyers are bargain hunters. They're looking for lower-priced housing, and they're big on buying foreclosures right now.
Yeah, the local paper in Georgia, where I was the beginning of this week, publishes every week a list of foreclosed homes in the counties. It ran 81 pages this week.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable, yeah.
And really underscores that we're not seeing the worst of it here.
Yeah, we don't see it here in Seattle, at least not yet. And I'll get to that here in a minute, too. Jobless claims this week, the Labor Department reported that it was not 605,000, as they reported earlier. It was 637,000 new jobless claims in the last month versus 610,000, which was what everyone expected it would be. So jobless claims are still worse than people expected. And even more disturbing is the number of people receiving unemployment rose to 6.56 million last month. That's a record. Well, last week, that's a record high for the 15th straight week. And that means that people, what that number really means is that people are having trouble finding new jobs and getting off of unemployment. So that's a sign that things are not improving yet, in spite of what pundits are saying.
Yeah, and there are plenty of people who are not on unemployment because they've been unemployed for so long.
Yeah, and here's the number that I think last week I told you that people were really, really happy because retail sales had gone up in the first quarter of the year. Well, retail sales in April fell for the second straight month versus that 2.2% increase in the first quarter. Well, it's been falling in March and April, which is a sign things are not getting better. And what I also want to point out, too, is that if you pay attention to investment managers and what they tell their big, rich investor clients, they say, well, you can expect your investments to improve and the economy to improve when consumer spending recovers. Well, I have to tell you, consumer spending is not going to get any better when people are out of work and are having trouble paying the bills and are being kicked out of their homes. What they found is that this week, 342,000 households received a foreclosure-related notice in April. April was the second straight month with more than 300,000 households around the nation receiving foreclosure filings. So foreclosures are not going down, they're going up. So those are all signs that we have not turned the corner. I just want to point out that the June issue of Fortune magazine had a very interesting article. This is after years of hyping home ownership and telling everybody it's the American dream and you can afford a home and you should buy a home. They had an article entitled "When It Makes Sense Not to Buy." And this
when
article,
when you're broke, you're about to file for bankruptcy.
Oh no, and it wasn't about any of those things. It wasn't about telling people the truth that many people should never buy a home, or that it wasn't about buying a house being an expensive luxury for the upper middle class, and it wasn't about how if you do buy a home, it's really forced retirement savings, but it's a very risky form because you've got all your assets your money tied up in one asset, and it's also a very inefficient way to save for retirement. But it was about how to show which cities are a good deal when you should time the housing market. So
in case you need somewhere to figure out where you're going to buy that seventh home.
Right. So even under, you know, under those constraints, the article was interesting because it took eight cities and it ran this little mathematical calculation to show where it was a good deal to buy a house. And places like Pittsburgh, for example, it's a good deal because rent is fairly expensive, but homes are fairly cheap. The city that flunked the test, where you should probably not be buying at all, everybody should be renting. Well, that city was Seattle. I thought I would just mention that because you're not going to hear that on as an announcement on the evening news tonight.
Yeah, or in the Seattle Times.
No, you won't see it in the Seattle Times. There was another interesting article in the Wall Street Journal this week that the Federal Reserve, we talked about this the last couple of weeks when we talked about the bank stress tests. Well, the Federal Reserve cut banks some slack in their stress tests after banks lobbied them to change the results. And I had mentioned something about this last week, saying it sure seemed like that happened, particularly in the case of Citigroup. Well, lots of banks did it. Bank of America's stress test results should have been a $50 billion hole in their capital. They got that reduced to $34 billion. Wells Fargo, their original results said $17.3 billion hole. Well, they got that reduced to $13.7 billion. Citigroup was the big winner. It had a $35 billion hole in its capital, and they got their results reduced down to $5.5 billion.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
Anyone that got their results increased?
Oh, there were a couple, but those were banks that didn't jump in and lobby to get their
Spend that money while they were lobbying.
So it's their fault,
Yeah. Yeah, they should have lined up with the lobbyists to go in there and lobby on their behalf.
And we gave them that money. I thought they were supposed to do that.
All right, and finally, I just want to very quickly say that the Obama administration sent a two-page letter to Congress this week requesting legislation that would regulate derivatives. That's a good first step to regulate an industry that many critics say really has magnified the economic downturn, and that accounts for some $684 trillion as of June 2008. That's what the derivatives market was valued at. Derivatives are contracts that are written in private and usually negotiated over the phone. They're not traded on an exchange. Nobody regulates them. The federal government has no idea what how many derivatives contracts are out there, what they're worth, what, you know, who owns them and who's written them up. And derivatives contracts like credit default swaps have been at the heart of the failure of companies like AIG. So,
all right. And finally, nationally, the Obama administration making some choices here in regards to the war on terror.
Yeah, a couple of somewhat disheartening developments this week. First, the Obama administration embracing the Bush idea of military tribunals. Obama telling Congress that he wanted to tweak the system. In other words, the government wants to continue to rig the judicial system in cases where they otherwise feel they couldn't win a conviction. They want to change the rules so that they can win a conviction, but they want to make it appear fairer now. The problem isn't that it needs to be tweaked. The problem is the basic premise that our judicial system is not good enough to secure a conviction, and that the goal is to secure a conviction regardless of whether people are guilty or not. That's the fundamental premise behind military tribunals, and it's the fundamental premise that is flawed. The other way in which Obama backtracked was in response to a lawsuit by the ACLU on the release of torture photos from the Bush era, where he had previously announced that he was going to, but backtracked ostensibly with the rationale that it would inflame anti-American sentiment around the world. Well, you know, we'll get to this in a minute if we have time, but the way you would stop inflaming anti-American sentiment is start murdering large numbers of innocent people. That would probably be a good start. Stop writing blanket checks to Israel for their occupation of Palestine. That would be a good start. Stop torturing prisoners at Bagram. That would be a good start. You know, there are any number of things that Obama could be doing or could stop doing that would fall under that argument. But the particularly disturbing thing about this particular reversal is that it's over a lawsuit where he's going to lose the lawsuit anyway. Those photos will come out eventually. This is basically a sop to the intelligence community to say, see, really, I'm on your side. I was forced to do this. And as a result, it gives credibility to the right. It gives credibility to the Bush administration, and it gives credibility to the process of torture as something that that bears the seal of approval of the office of the president. And we've seen that also with Obama's embrace of the state secrets doctrine of the Bush era, with his claiming the right to continue to torture prisoners at Bagram, the base in Afghanistan, any number of different pieces where his policies have been very disappointing, to say the least.
Yeah, his proposal to revive the military tribunals and just tweak them a little bit, that's really disturbing to me. I want to read a paragraph from an Associated Press story about it, and it explains it as well as I ever could. It's the second to last paragraph in the article.
Naturally.
Yeah, naturally. And it says, quote, "The decision to restart the process puts the administration in a race against the clock to conclude commission trials before the Navy prison is closed by January 2010. They're talking about Guantanamo. If the trials are still going on, the detainees might have to be brought to the United States, where they would receive even greater legal rights.
Heaven forbid.
Heaven forbid that anybody be allowed legal rights. I mean, that's been the whole issue. The whole root cause of the problem with Guantanamo that you're putting people in a gray area, and then you're not allowing them legal rights.
Yeah, but it's putting them in the gray area in the first place.
Regardless of who they are.
These people are prisoners of war who shouldn't be on trial in the first place.
Yeah, and they should be allowed their rights under the Geneva Convention. And the fact that they're trying to rush through these trials in order to kind of deal with them before they have to address those issues is very disturbing.
It's despicable, actually.
Only less than 2 minutes left to cover Pakistan.
Yeah, the Pakistani military is continuing to heavily shell the Swat Valley. And last week, we talked about this a little bit. I said there were 500,000 refugees created in 1 week. Now that's up to almost 1 million refugees. They are gathering in camps that are fairly close to the Pakistani capital. And so Pakistani citizens are able to turn on their TVs every evening and see on video, able to see refugees fighting over blankets and food. And this is not helping the profile of the Pakistani government. I think the Pakistani citizenship is really, I want to say a word I shouldn't say on air, but they're really mad at their at their government. And a large part of it is because they're hearing refugees say to the cameras, they came and they bombed the crap out of my village and it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
They're just doing carpet bombing, and both sides, both the Taliban and the Pakistani military, are relying heavily on artillery. They're not really engaging each other on the ground like you would expect them to do if they wanted to spare the civilian population. They're really taking it out on the infrastructure and the people who live there. And that's going to destroy the credibility of the Pakistani government at home as well as abroad, because the UN Human Rights Commission and Commission for Refugees is saying that it's going to take an international effort to try to help the million plus people that this conflict is going to displace.
Yeah, imagine what the response of the world and the American populace have been if the Bush administration had blown up the levees in New Orleans, and you start maybe to get the sense of what this is doing
for
the Pakistani
people feel. Yeah.
All right. With that, we're out of time. Talking, as we do every week, with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with news and opinions about the world around us, local, global, and in between. It's run by volunteers, and we are in the midst of our annual spring pledge drive. Well, it's annual. Sometimes it's in spring. It's whenever we feel like it, basically.
Whenever we need the money.
Whenever we're broke. Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. And we're broke now. So if you can help out, we would very much appreciate it. We have a PayPal button on our website, which is www.eatthestate.org, or you can send checks or money orders to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145, for your support of your favorite independent media here in Seattle, along with Mind Over Matters, of course. If you want to find the print version of Eat the State, it shows up at bookstores and coffee shops and King County Library System, places where you find free periodicals. Or, as I mentioned, we're on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback about anything you've heard here on the program, give us an email. Our email is info@eatthestate.org.